So the past week saw the 10-year anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. At the same time, President Obama was making his first trip to Israel and the Middle East as president. Not first trip as president, but as he'd been to Egypt before, of course, but went to Israel, went to Jordan, where he did not go as Iraq, right? Which I think tells you something about the current state of U.S.-Iraqi relations. The U.S. relationship with Iraq is moving towards where it's a normal relationship between two states, not the relationship that characterized the time when the U.S. was occupying it. John Kerry went to Iraq and talked about the issues that were most important for the United States from the perspective about the relationship. He emphasized two things. He emphasized the U.S. wanting Iraq to land Iranian planes that are flying over Iraqi airspace to resupply the Assad regime. And second, putting some pressure on the Iraqi government not to postpone provincial elections in two of the governorates where they've said they're going to postpone them because of protests and uprisings inside Iraq. So that's basically where it's at now. I mean, it's moving towards a normalized relationship. There's the number of U.S. troops, number of U.S. diplomatic personnel in Iraq is going down, down, down. And all that's happening at the same time as this commemoration of 10 years of the beginning of a war that cost the United States 4,400 dead servicemen, about 32,000 wounded U.S. servicemen. And estimates vary, but cost the United States probably about $2 trillion.
How did we get to this point, I guess, in the last 10 years? What has been the trajectory of the relationship?
Well, I mean, so this is a long conversation, right, about why the U.S. invaded Iraq to begin with, what it did there. But what the United States did is it set up an electoral system in Iraq where the people who won the elections were not the people whom the U.S. wanted to win the election. Right? Some people in the Bush administration planned to hand Iraq over as quickly as possible to Ahmed Chalabi. That did not happen. And the people the United States wanted to do well in the elections in 2005 were secularist candidates, especially Iyad Alawi, who did not do well. And to the credit of the Bush administration, I don't think many people give the Bush administration credit for this, the people who won those early elections in Iraq and subsequent elections were Shia Islamists. It was the Dawah Party. It was the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and their allies. The Islamist Shia parties won the elections. The United States let them come to power. And they're the ones who are currently governing Iraq today. These are groups that are close to Iran, not run by Iran, and they vary. We can talk about that if you'd like. But these are not the people the United States wanted to be running Iraq. But they won the elections, and that's been respected. And Iraq continues to hold elections. They're going to be they had parliamentary elections 2 years ago, and they're going to have provincial elections next month. And right now, if we were in Baghdad or any other Iraqi city, the walls would be plastered with campaign posters.
What was that you were mentioning about the party that's very close to Iran?
What used to be called the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They changed their name over time, but they've always been close to the Iranian government. They were formed basically by the Iranian government during the Iran-Iraq War, and they fought on Iran's side during the Iran-Iraq War. They've come back, and they're expected to do fairly well in some of the provincial elections next month.
Okay. Does Iraq's government, is it secularist? Does it lean towards an Islamic sort of rule?
They're Islamists. They're Shia Islamists that dominate it. The thing about Iraqi the national politics in Iraq is that over the past, say, 4 to 5 years, the prime minister, Maliki, has steadily consolidated power in his own office. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fear that he's becoming a dictator or a dictator light. And it's certainly true that he's consolidated control. Power goes through him, controls a lot of key military units. There's an awful lot of money to be made if you have good connections to him and people in his office. And there's numerous attempts to bring him down. Every month or two, there's rumors about Parliament being able to topple him or pulling certain groups out of his coalition. There was this Iyad Alawi, who runs one of the secular blocs, pulled out of the government, and there was fear they'd bring him down. The rumors this week are that somebody who previously had called him a dictator, Saleh Mutlak, a Sunni, might actually end up joining the cabinet as defense minister. So there's always attempts to bring him down. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't have unchecked power, but he's done extraordinarily well in keeping that seat, and keeping his hold on power, mm-hmm. and consolidating power in basically the prime minister's office.
So you may have said this earlier. What is the U.S.'s view of him?
I'm sure the United States government wished for a long time that he was more pliable, that they could have more influence over him. I think if you're in Washington and you ask people about U.S. or Iraqi relations, There's people who think that the Iraqi government basically are pawns of Iran, and that Iran has a lot more influence there. And that's primarily from people who want to put more pressure on Iran or want the United States to put more pressure on Iran for all sorts of reasons. The Iran nuclear program, because of the threat Iran supposedly poses to Israel and other allies in the region. And there's other people, though, who I think recognize that the Iraqi government is independent. It's pursuing its own interests. And those might not be the interests of the Iraqi people, or all the Iraqi people, but the Maliki is he's in it for Maliki. I mean, he's, Iraqi politics is almost indescribably corrupt. I mean, it's just really? Over the top right now, corrupt and nepotistic. I forget the exact number. So there's a very active parliament. So lots of evidence and data comes out of parliamentarians' offices where they give examples of stuff. And I forget the exact numbers here, but it was a year or two ago when one of the parliamentarians publicized the incoming class of diplomats in the Iraqi Foreign Ministry for that term or whatever. They admitted, I think, 132 new diplomats. Every single one of them was the son or a daughter or some relative of somebody with high government position. I mentioned if you were in Baghdad in Iraqi city today, you see campaign posters everywhere. None of those campaign posters would say anything about policy. They wouldn't be anything but ideological positions. It would be, I'm from this tribe, or I'm from this community, or vote for me because of who my relative is. And it's all about getting access to power and then having some sort of connection where they will channel jobs, money, influence to you.
Interesting.
That's what Iraqi politics is
about. Would you say that this sort of nepotism then has hindered the Iraqi government in any way?
Oh, hindered? Well, I mean, it depends what sort of government you were expecting to have there. I mean, this isn't a shining beacon of democracy on the hill. But I think it's very easy just to look at Iraq and describe it in sectarian terms, Sunni, Shia, Kurd. And by the way, when people say that, what they really mean is Sunni Arab, Shia Arab, and Kurds of both, right? Because Kurd Arab is a linguistic cleavage. Sunni Shia is a quite separate cleavage. Mm-hmm. It's important to keep in mind because Maliki has tried to present himself at times as an Arab nationalist or Iraqi nationalist, and so tried to kind of unite Sunni and Shias behind him. You could also imagine a different politician trying to unite Arab Sunnis and Kurds on their shared Sunni identity, so it's important to keep those cleavages in mind. But right now in Iraq, there's a couple months ago, Maliki went after some very prominent Sunni Arab politicians. Tariq al-Hashimi, who was branded a traitor who fled. I think he's still in Turkey today. He was charged in absentia. And then most recently, Maliki went after the former finance minister who ended up fleeing Deir al-Anbar. And so for the past month, there have been large-scale protests going on by Sunni Arabs in two provinces, in al-Anbar and then up near Mosul. And so people have looked at Iraq and they're trying to describe this as Sunni-Shia conflict, and it's certainly true that Maliki could have restarted some sort of sectarian conflict there. But Iraqi politics is much more complex than just Sunni, Shia, Kurds. There's as much competition and infighting within those communities as there is between them.
Do people in Iraq have confidence in their government, would you say, or are they aware of the corruption? Are they angry about it?
Well, they're certainly angry at it. I mean, Iraq has a tremendous number of problems in it. But there was when the Arab Spring began, the so-called Arab Spring began, there were a number of protests that started in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Baghdad has a square called Tahrir Square, some Iraqis saw as a domestic parallel. And so for the first few months after Mubarak was overthrown in Egypt, protesters, this is 2011, tried to seize that central square in Baghdad, and the regime wouldn't let them, prevented them from getting at. Those numbers dwindled over time. But a couple months later, I think by May or June, basically, the protesters had gone into Tahrir Square and nothing was going on. And the LA Times did this pretty humorous article where they were describing the scene in Tahrir Square, that the protesters who are out there every Friday, they're out there because it seems like they have nothing better to do. And the police officers, who a few months earlier had been beating them, trying to prevent them from getting to that space, are just looking at their watches, bored, waiting to go home. And they interview some of these people out there protesting. And they say, we don't want to overthrow the government. We want the government to do what we elected them to do, right? Which is provide services, provide electricity, provide jobs and opportunity, but not trying to overthrow the regime. And I think that pretty much captures where Iraqis are at. They're very disillusioned with the current government because it hasn't delivered. There's still power cuts.
And do you think that's in relation, you mentioned that it was partially related to the Arab Spring. Do you think that spurred more dissatisfaction, or was that there before the Arab Spring?
Oh, it was there long before the Arab Spring.
Okay.
Remember, Iraq before, so I was in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. Remember, Iraq had just gone through a decade of sanctions, right? Mm-hmm. So people didn't have cell phones, they didn't, cable television, no satellite television, those were illegal. People's salaries were extremely low, I think like $7. People couldn't afford cars, and then as soon as the U.S. invaded, Iraqis' expectations were through the roof. They thought Iraq was going to be like a rich Gulf state because of oil within a year or two. Right? I was in Basra mostly, and people thought Basra was going to be the new Dubai. Grand plans of developing the country. And I'm sure you've seen these images of Dubai with the buildings and glass facades. That's what Iraqis were expecting. And years and years and years went by, and that wasn't achieved, despite different governments. The occupation came and went, and that hadn't been developed. The first few years, Iraqis were running off, getting in all just basic sort of things they were missing. And we tend to think that they were all sitting around talking about democracy, but... You know, the Iraqis I knew, the first thing they did was go out and buy a new television and then a satellite. And the way it works in Iraq is you just, or many Arab countries, you buy a satellite dish for like $100, $120, and you get free to air about 300 to 400 channels. Right? You don't have to pay a monthly fee. And suddenly Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, tons of channels from other Gulf from Gulf states, all sorts of stuff gets beamed into your house. Mm-hmm. Then people were doing basic sort of stuff. New pipes for their house to improve water flow, plastic tanks that were too expensive under the sanctions period to have on your roof that you can pump water up to, so have running hot water, microwaves, all sorts of things that just weren't available in Iraq before. Mm-hmm. So when you hear about power being bad, how many hours of electricity you have, remember the demand for electricity is shot through the roof. Mm-hmm. So those are the first order things that people wanted, just basic things that they knew other people had in the world, right? These, Saddam's son ran a television station where they would pirate Channel 2 movies, American movies, and show them. So people in, they knew other Arabs. They saw people from the Gulf. So they knew the things they didn't have. So they got all those. But what Iraqis have been extremely disappointed in is that the government hasn't provided adequate jobs. The oil wealth hasn't made them very wealthy. The roads are still in poor disrepair. Buildings are still falling apart. Services haven't improved. It's unbelievably corrupt in terms of you have to have powerful friends and connections to get anything done. And the violence has continued. I mean, the battle days of 2007, 2008, those were horrible, horrible, horrible days. But there's been an ongoing insurgency in large parts of the country, continued suicide bombings and attacks for over a decade now. There's still ongoing attacks. It ebbs and flows. I mean, there's groups still affiliated with the remnants of Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers, which is what U.S. military always called them AQ, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but the group never called themselves that. It was always Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers. So they're still there. They're launching some attacks. There's a lot of fear now that violence from Iraq, from Syria, will spill over. Right? There's an awful lot of fear that... Sunni Islamists, if they come to power in Eastern Syria or in Damascus itself, that will have a spillover effect into Western Iraq. Syria is in a very bad shape. Cover of the Economist, it says Syria, the death of a country. Syria is going to have ripple effects through the Middle East for a decade. Mm-hmm. It probably will destabilize Lebanon in the not too distant future. And there's a good chance it'll spill over and have violent effects in what's happening in Iraq.
The fear that you were talking about in terms of like suicide bombers, would you say it's lower now than it was maybe at the start of the Iraq war or earlier than that? Or has it kind of like maintained the same level throughout?
Well, the violence has gone down. I mean, the worst of the violence was the sectarian violence that occurred in 2006, 2007. Those were really, really bad days. The Iraqi government, the Iraqi military is much stronger than it was well, there was no Iraqi military. Mm-hmm. The U.S. disbanded it in 2003, 2004. Took a lot of time to build it back. And then after they built it back, the police were a disaster for a long time. The police were infiltrated by militia organizations. Now Iraq has a military that's able to maintain day-to-day order in most of the country. Not in the Kurdish areas, right? The Kurdish areas are self-governing. They have their own military forces. And Baghdad doesn't have much to do with them, which is how the Kurds want it up there. But throughout most of the rest of the country, I was last in Basra, Iraq, 2 years ago, and police were everywhere. And that's a city that basically had slipped out of the government's control for several years. It was run by local militias. And it was in 2008 when Maliki launched something called Operation Charge of the Knights, where the Iraqi military, with U.S. air power overhead, went back and took the city from Shia Islamists. And so that Basra is a nice example of it, that the government completely lost control of the city from 2006, 2007, 2008. But from 2008, they've held it. And the military's there, they maintain order.
Going back slightly to what you were saying about Syria possibly destabilizing Iraq, mm-hmm. in general, how have Iraq's relations with other countries in the Middle East changed over the last 10 years?
Well, the big change was Iraq was the Arab counterbalance to Iran, right? Mm-hmm. After the Iranian Revolution in 1979, a government comes to power in Iran that's hostile to both Arab nationalists, the republics, mm-hmm. like Iraq and Syria and Egypt, but also to the monarchies, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf monarchies, Jordan, and was threatening both of them. Throughout the 1980s, there was an 8-year-long Iran-Iraq war, and that was funded by other Arab countries paying Iraq to fight on their behalf. Right? Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. So Iraq was the counterbalance for the Arab world, especially Saudi Arabia, against Iran. Well, you know, after 1991, Iraq invaded Kuwait for a number of reasons, one of which was Kuwait did not forgive some of the debt from the war that Iraq had incurred. The United States came in and basically destroyed Iraq's military capability and then imposed sanctions. And so then the United States had to balance against Iran for the Gulf states for quite a while. What's happened now is the United States removed from power Iran's greatest military adversary in the region. It's not Israel. It was always Iraq. They removed Saddam Hussein, completely wiped out any military capability that Iraq would have for a decade to threaten Iran, and installed a government in Baghdad that's friendly, or at least friendlier, certainly much friendlier to Tehran than the government that was there before. So the United States did Iran a huge favor, right? Iran's thrilled. This is great for them. Not only is their main military adversary gone, there's a friendly government there, tons of Iranian investment in Iraq, tons of Iranian pilgrims. The holiest sites in Shiism, other than Mecca and Medina, of course, are in Iraq. Najaf, Karbala, Samarra, and lots of Iranian pilgrims come there, lots of business relations, lots of trade relations. So Iran's thrilled. Iran's very happy.
And the other countries in the area, how are they responding to this, like, the new friendlier relations between Iraq and Iran?
Well, I mean, so it depends if you want to understand Middle Eastern politics in terms of sectarianism. There's a lot of people who argue that there was basically you should think about a Shia crescent through the region, right? A line of Shia countries that are allied together and are rivals to Sunni countries. I don't think that's a useful way of thinking about the Middle East. I think the foreign policies of the Middle East right now are largely determined by what some people have called a new Middle Eastern Cold War. And this is a Cold War between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think it's correct to say that it's being played out in the domestic politics of weak states. What you see is Saudi Arabia and Iran competing within countries that are domestically weak. Like Iraq, like Yemen, like Palestine, and now in Syria. And they're not fighting each other directly, but they're fighting through proxies. And that is one way to understand what was happening in Iraq. It was basically Iran. Part of the violence in Iraq was groups getting some support from Saudi Arabia and other groups getting some support from Iran. And that's certainly what's happening in Syria today. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, where Cornell University has a campus, very actively supporting the rebels in Syria. And Iran has gone all in supporting the Assad regime.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So I guess that being said, where do you see things going forward in the country and then in the country's relations with others in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, so you look back 10 years and try to project forward what things would look like today, and it's extremely, extremely difficult to do. So you're saying in 10 years, what is Iraq going to look like? I don't think Iraq is going to break up, but the regions of Iraq are no more unified today than they were in 2003. There's deep divisions there politically. It's not just Sunni, Shia, Kurds. There's deep divisions within Iraq, and that's going to be difficult for them to overcome. Maliki going after these Sunni, prominent Sunni leaders the way he has, it really could restart a civil war, a very nasty civil war in Iraq. And we'll see how that happens. We'll see the extent to which Syria destabilizes what's happening there in Iraq. Maliki is extremely concerned. I wouldn't say that the Iraqi government has been backing the Syrian government, but they certainly don't want it to fall. They certainly don't want it to fall quickly. they're very concerned about Syria, about Sunni Islamists coming to power in Damascus, which looks like will happen at some point in the next 5 to 10 years.
I think that's it, unless there's anything else you want to add.
You know, what's really stunning is the complete lack of interest in what's happening in Iraq now. I think the Iraq war disillusioned an awful lot of Americans about not just foreign intervention, but what the U.S. can achieve on the ground in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And you look at the last week or two of commemorations of the 10-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. A few supporters came out and made statements about why they did it and ended up blaming not the decision to go to war, but mistakes made during the administration. Nobody can argue that it wasn't a bungled occupation. Huge mistakes were made. Some disagreement over what were the biggest mistakes, but lots of mistakes were made. A lot of Democrats came out and apologized for having supported the war to begin with. But other than that, I think the anniversary of this 10-year-long war went unnoticed. And I think it was there was an obligatory story or two on the news and the paper, but I think both the United States and Iraq have moved past it.